Good morning and welcome to the latest edition of the Redefine podcast. This is Adam Emerson, and we are fortunate to have with us here today Dr. Howard Fuller, who is to us, inarguably, a pioneering figure in the cause for parental choices in education, and tens of thousands of low-income parents and students in Milwaukee can thank him for that. And that is the reason why we wanted to speak with him today. As many heard this week, Dr. Fuller had strong words for Wisconsin legislatures who would consider eliminating the income threshold for entry into the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. He plainly told them that if that change was to become law, he would become an opponent of the program, one for which he has fought for more than 20 years. Dr. Fuller has been a leader in the cause of civil rights. He has served as superintendent in Milwaukee Public Schools. He founded the Black Alliance for Educational Options, and he is now a distinguished professor of education at Marquette University. The implications of his concerns should be taken seriously, and we're hoping he'll help us explore what the future might hold, not only for the Milwaukee program, but also the trends in school choice initiatives gaining momentum nationwide. So with that, Dr. Fuller, I thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You closed your remarks to the Joint Finance Committee in Wisconsin this week by saying that you would never support a program that essentially provides a subsidy for rich people. The Milwaukee program now serves only low-income students, those from a household living at 175% of poverty. What is the line you draw? In your opinion, at what point does any change in the income threshold begin to dilute the mission of the program?
Well, let me explain this, because I did not say that without really understanding the implications. And obviously, it's very difficult for a person like myself who has fought for something for 20 years to take a position that I would go the other way and oppose something that, you know, like I fought for. So I think it does deserve an explanation, and I clearly understand that there are people out there who will disagree with me profoundly. But when I got into this battle in 1989, the reason why we got into the battle was because the city of Milwaukee was failing to educate poor black children. And we have fought a number of community struggles over the years and had moved to a point where we felt like one of the options that ought to exist was choice for poor parents. And the heroine of this whole battle was State Representative Annette Polly Williams, a black Democrat, and I actually went to high school with Polly, who back in 1988-89 had the courage to stand up and say, poor parents ought to have vouchers. And it's very important that people understand, and I'm just speaking for myself, When I came to the voucher movement, it was always from the standpoint of social justice. And in fact, the movement to vouchers was a progression of community struggles that had taken place. We had tried to, for example, create a separate school district in Milwaukee to educate low-income children. We had tried to get MPS, the Milwaukee Public Schools, to do a better job. And so our progression to vouchers was more along the line of, we tried to get MPS to do something about the problem. We tried to create our own district. None of those were possible. So give us a way out. And to be honest with you, I had never read Capitalism and Freedom at the point in time that I first started supporting vouchers. I read it later. So it never was coming out of that philosophical basis. It was always coming out of another philosophical base, which, as I said, was this notion of social justice. And so over the years, people like me have taken blows from people who've accused us of being tools for the right wing or things much stronger than that. But one of the arguments that they've made over and over again was that people like me were being duped because we thought that this was really about poor people. But the real objective was to use poor people to get the program established. And then once you get the program established, the real agenda was to have this become a subsidy for people of means. And I want to say very clearly, I've never believed that in terms of that was true for all of the Republicans or business people or other people who've supported the program from day one. So, for example, I believe that a person like John Kirtley has been and continues to be a person who champions the program because he believes that it's important to give low-income and working-class people these options. But there have always been people in the choice, quote, coalition who've said over and over again they believe in universal vouchers. Mm-hmm. And every time it's been raised with me, I've said to them as clearly as I could, if you all go for universal vouchers, I'm not with that, and I will oppose it, mm-hmm. because that's not why I got into this. And so I've always been clear. As clear as they've been, I've been equally clear. So when this proposal came out, I felt it was critical that I voice my opposition to it. And there's various reasons that people give for it. For example, one of the arguments that they make is that programs for poor people never survive. And so what you got to do is you got to expand the number of people who support it, because poor people don't vote, they're not politically powerful. So you got to get people who are politically powerful to quote protect the program. Mm-hmm. But the only way they'll ultimately protect the program is that they have to get something out of the program. So therefore, you come to a conclusion that to get support in the city of Milwaukee, you have to go to a universal voucher. But here's some data that people who are listening to this should understand. Number one, the median income level for households in the city of Milwaukee is $34,898. 66% of city of Milwaukee households have a household income of less than $50,000. 83.2% of households have a household income of less than $75,000. So what I've said to people is, look, I understand that the threshold that we set 20 years ago should be reviewed, because the threshold now is, in order to be in the program, you have to be at 175% of poverty. And you can stay in the program up to 220% of poverty. So what I've suggested is there's a health insurance program in Wisconsin for low-income and moderate-income people called Badger Care. And Badger Care allows people to get into the program up to 300% of poverty, which is roughly $68,700, I think, or something like that, for a family of four. And so what I've said is, why don't we then move the program to the Badger Care maximum, and that would capture over 80% of the households in the city. So if your real objective is to expand the level of support, you could do that and still retain a focus on low-income and moderate-income families, particularly in a city where the median income is $34,898. So that's as succinctly as I can explain it, the context for the debate and the difference of opinion on the program.
Mm-hmm. So you would support increasing the threshold at this point, or at least consider reviewing where the threshold is at this point.
I would support moving it, because I understand the difficulty that low-income working people have and moderate-income working people have. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me if you have a program like Badger Care that's set up to meet the needs of those individuals, it would be a point of justice and okay to say, okay, let's go to 300% of poverty then, which is the Badger Care number, and, you know, establish once you're in, so you could cut back on some of the administrative nightmares and trying to, you know, prove income and all of this, and you would have a program that I think would still be consistent with the fundamental reason why we fought for the program in the first place.
But if this were to raise all income level, all income requirements, if this were to open up to anybody in Milwaukee, this is what you would oppose.
Yes, because what that would mean is that a person like myself who has the means, if I was young enough and had school-age children, I have the means to pay for private school if that's what I want to do with my kids. There's no way in the world that I'm ever going to stand up and say, okay, here's someone who's making $200,000 a year. We're going to give them a subsidy of $6,500 so they can send their kids to private schools. I'm not fighting for that. Now, there are people out there who are going to fight for it, you know, and I say God bless them, but I'm not only not going to fight for it, I'm going to oppose it because I think it's fundamentally wrong.
Now, a lot of states are picking up on their own voucher or tax credit proposals, and not all of them are means testing their plans toward low-income children. How do you feel about the state of the private choice movement nationally and where it's heading?
Well, I mean, I think we're coming to a point of decision here. And it's a valid, you know, point. And if the movement is going to now move towards universal vouchers or tax credits that will have no means tests whatsoever, I personally will oppose it and won't be a part of that movement. I literally, philosophically, cannot. And so, you know, it may very well be that it's time for people like me to, you know, I use the get off the train, but really to get off the stage, because maybe it has to be a different movement going forward. But if that's the way the movement has to be going forward, it's not something that I can be a part of.
Now, you have emerged in the last couple of years as a real gatekeeper of quality in the Milwaukee program. And that's led to some dissension and hard feelings in the movement. There's a heightened degree of regulation and accountability in the program now. Why is that important for you?
Because at the end of the day, this is not about ideology. It's about kids, and it's about doing what's right by kids. And it's clear to me after 20 years in this program that parent choice alone does not equate to quality, and that parents will continue to choose terrible schools. And so I think you need a combination of parent choice and what I will call smart regulation. And there are some things you can do without over-regulating the program. I understand that any regulation could be the camel's nose under the tent to totally regulate. I also understand that there are people out there who believe the way to kill the program is by over-regulating it. And so I'm mindful of that. But at the same time, I can't sit idly by and see people starting schools who have no business starting schools, people running schools who don't have the capacity to run schools, the outliers who have ripped off taxpayers, and it hasn't been that many of them, but people who've started schools and bought Mercedes, and you can't see those things happen and not try to figure out a way to find a compromise between no regulation and over-regulation. And I think we're smart enough as a movement to figure out a way to guard quality, because at the end of the day, our inability to guard quality is used as a hammer against the program. And so, you know, I felt like we needed to work differently than we had in the past. And another critical part of this, just so that everyone understands what we're dealing with here, is for years I've been told that the key to the long-term solution or long-term sustenance of these programs is to make it bipartisan. And so in 2008, I worked very hard to get black Democrats to support the program. Because quite frankly, without the support of black Democrats in the city of Milwaukee, the program would have been killed in 2008. But their support, they were willing to support, but they wanted some of these accountability measures, which I thought, quite frankly, were reasonable. What's going to happen is, if the Wisconsin legislature goes ahead and supports what the governor has proposed, then everybody out there who supports the voucher program had better pray that the Democrats never come back to power. Because if they do, the first thing that's going to be killed is this program. And so we're not only doing something that I think is philosophically wrong, I think it is also politically short-sighted. Because we have gotten to a point where we now have black Democrats who are prepared to support the program, but they're not going to support a program that they view and I view as a subsidy for the rich. That's not going to happen. And what you do, ironically, is you give the opponents of vouchers a gift, because they will take this and they will use it all over the country to run Democrats away from the program and to continue to point out that all of this is about the broad effort that people have to subsidize rich people. And so, I mean, it just makes no sense to do this politically. And so at the end of the day, I'm left with the viewpoint that this is all about ideology.
Now, last month, we saw the results, speaking in terms of quality, of the first comparative assessment using statewide exams between students in the school district and students in the choice program. It's only 1 year of data, but the results show that students in the choice program perform no better on the exams than students in the school district. What was your reaction to that when that came out last month?
My reaction is that, number one, we have to do better. Number two, there are two elements to choice. One is choice. There's a power to having choice. So when people say students don't do any better, The issue, though, is do you now therefore want to deny parents the option of being able to go to schools that do better? Because not all of the schools did not do better. Some of them did much better. And the real purpose of choice is to give people who have not previously had options the ability to choose. Now, the second thing that we have to work on is to improve the schools that they will have the choice to attend. Because a voucher is not a school. It's a mechanism. It's a funding mechanism to get people to a school. And because we've not yet turned the corner where all of the schools that people are attending are better, that is not a reason to deny parents the power to choose. Because if that's the case, then you should shut down the whole traditional public school system, because vast numbers of those schools are not serving people well at all. And so to me, it's not logical to say, okay, because all of the schools are not giving kids a better education, you should shut down the option of choice that parents have. Because you're not going to shut down the traditional public school structure because not all of the schools serve kids well. The second point I would make is that it's incumbent on those of us then who support freedom to choose to fight for quality, because freedom is illusionary if you don't have the ability to choose from something other than mediocrity. The third point I would make is we're doing almost as well with half the money. And so one of the things people got to understand is if I'm over trying to make a school work and I've only got $6,500 per kid and you got a school making $13,000, with all due respect, money does matter. Mm-hmm. Now, it matters how you use it. But if I've got $13,000 per kid at our school, I'm confident that I could do so much better than what we're currently doing, because I would have a level of resources that I currently do not have. And because there's never been equity in funding, it's very difficult to make an argument that someone who's getting half the money should be doing as well as someone, you know, who's getting double what you're getting. And a part of this, though, is our fault. Because, again, a number of people made the argument that we can do it better and we can do it cheaper. Now, we can do it cheaper, but not half cheaper. And some of the people who were making the argument that you know, these poor kids, they only need so much amount per pupil, they don't have their kids in schools trying to operate with that amount of money.
Well, Dr. Fuller, I think one likely effect of your remarks in Wisconsin this week is that we're all going to be watching the proceedings a little more closely. But do you have any final thoughts you can leave us with on either Milwaukee or the trends we're seeing in school choice nationally?
Well, the only comment I would make is that, or a couple of comments. Number one, I do believe that we should not have an America where only people with money have the ability to choose. And I will continue to fight for vouchers, tax credit, opportunity scholarship programs, charter schools, homeschooling, virtual schools, anything that empowers low-income and working-class people to be able to have some of the capacity to choose that those of us with money have. I will never fight for giving people who already have means more resources, because in the end, that will disadvantage and squeeze out the possibility of poor parents having some of these options. And number two, that those of us who do believe, as I believe, that we also have a moral responsibility to take a stand on quality and to do whatever it takes to ensure that when these parents exercise their choice, that there are quality options for them and their children.
Well, on that, Dr. Howard Fuller, thank you for joining us today. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.